The recording is on. Steve, you are live and please proceed.
All right, thank you so much. Good morning. It's really an opportunity. It's an honor to be speaking with you this morning, and I'd really like to thank you for the opportunity, and thank you, Mark, for thinking of me. This week and next week, I want to talk about a subject on which I'm very passionate, and I honestly and sincerely believe it's the most critical issue facing the global Christian church. The title of this talk is Male and Female, Created He Them. Now, unless you've been hiding under a rock for the last 10 years, you may have seen some of these headlines. During much of my lifetime, the mainline Protestant churches and to a lesser degree, the Catholic Church were losing members at an alarming rate. Now, we took comfort as evangelicals in the belief that it's just because of liberalism, because the evangelical churches seem to be continuing to thrive. And that was true for quite some time. But recently, there have been trends in these churches that have called that into question. And we're finding that people are dropping out at increasing rates once they reach adulthood and independence. Now, the possible reasons for this are limited truly only by one's imagination and the number of books you're willing to read or podcasts or sermons or videos you're willing to consume. Let's look at some of these possible explanations. It seems everybody has a solution of some sort. Some say that Christians just need to be praying more for their children, praying for the lost and for national revival. And of course, that's very biblical and sounds very spiritual, but where does that leave us really? You know, how much prayer is enough? Is God holding out on his blessings because we're 100 short on a number of prayer warriors? Others will say what we need is more sound biblical teaching from the pulpits. And this certainly has a certain appeal. It makes sense if, like me, you were living in the 60s and 70s and 80s when it was the liberal churches that were losing members. But in these times, even the churches with sound biblical teaching are still losing members. Faithful preaching of the Bible has no magical power to bring people to Christian maturity or keep them in the pews. Recently, I read a biography of Jonathan Edwards, and for decades, he faithfully taught the Bible in the church he grew up in, his father's church. But even Edwards was run out of his own church for trying to implement some basic reforms, like insisting that parents be believers before baptizing their children, so un-British of them, or that only true believers could partake of communion. These are things we take for granted today, but he was run out of his church for these. So, you know, maybe preaching isn't really the only answer there. Some will argue that it's because Christians are not sufficiently engaged in the political arena and have turned over the sub-public realm to secular forces. On the other hand, some will say it's because Christians are too political and are running away potential converts. Again, many will argue it's because the global church is compromised with theological liberalism and abandoned Orthodox doctrine, and as a result, God has just cut them loose. And for much of my life, I would have held to that belief. And I still do to some extent, but even this seems quite adequate. Now, Mr. Hamm will tell you that the reason people are leaving the church is because the churches are embracing the idea that the earth is millions of years old. Now, that's an interesting thought, Ed, but it proves the old axiom that when your only tool is a hammer, the whole world is a nail. He actually has no evidence to support that idea. Whatever it is that we've been doing, it doesn't seem to be working. So maybe we need to start looking in other directions. One thing I have not mentioned in that list is apologetics. Now, if you know anything about me, you know I'm a member of the RTB scholar community. This means, obviously, that I'm persuaded that apologetics are really important. But what is the purpose of apologetics? It seems like most people think the idea of apologetics is to convert atheists into believers, argue for the existence of God, or to browbeat them with the force of your arguments so that the lost and seekers have to surrender to the power of your arguments. But let me suggest something different. In an article written not long before he died, R.C. Sproul mentioned that there were three purposes for apologetics. The first is to answer the critics of the faith. The second is to tear down the intellectual idols of our culture. But what he said was the most important role, and one that I feel has been sadly neglected, is to encourage the saints to shore up the church, in short, to make disciples. And if there's any area in which apologetics are more desperately needed today, it would have to be the domain of human sexuality. But it has to be done soberly and thoughtfully. Just like in the creation arena, bad apologetics can end up doing more harm than good. You have to use sound science. I might remind some of you of a senatorial candidate in Arkansas a few years ago who got a lot of notoriety for saying women could not get pregnant as a consequence of rape. Now, that was wildly untrue and unscientific. And, you know, he didn't come up with that idea. I know he got it from someone out there who was promoting that belief, but he needed to check what something that seemed wildly implausible against more respectable sources and not just take it at face value. So why sexual apologetics? Apologetics is to build up the church, then my approach here is not to teach sexual apologetics to the unbelievers, but what we need to be teaching our church members and what we need to be teaching our youth and college students. Mark Regnerus is a professor of sociology at the University of Texas at Austin. He's an eminent researcher, and his books, he's published four so far, are published by this little fly-by-night publishing house called the Oxford University Press. You may have heard of it. Yeah, it's the Oxford in UK, the university is about 800 years old. Now, his years of research in the area of sexuality culminated in a 2017 column in the Washington Post where Regnerus asserts, it's not science that's secularizing Americans, it's sex. Now, this is just one quote of many, many I could come. T.H. Huxley, who wrote Brave New World in a work called Ends and Means, said the main reason he didn't want to believe in God and he didn't want to believe in Christianity is because it would limit his sexual freedom. So this is by no means a new concept, but these people were speaking a profound truth. I'm going to be referring to the work of Mark Regnerus quite a bit in the next few minutes, especially some of the work from his most recent two books called Cheap Sex and the Future of Christian Marriage that was just released last September. Just to drive the point home, some of you may have noticed this headline just from last month of Christianity Today, the cohabitation dilemma comes from American pastors. So what I'd like to do this morning is to lay out the fundamentals of a Christian sexual apologetic. And since RTB is a very creation-oriented ministry, I thought it was quite appropriate to begin with creation. And with that, the creation of Adam and Eve. In Genesis 1:27, we read, so God created man in his own image. In the image of God, he created him. Male and female, he created them. Now, I'm going to propose that in this and in related passages, the Bible makes three very specific claims with regard to human sexuality, which we can examine in great detail from a scientific and secular viewpoint and find complete validation of what the Bible says. Even more, I would argue that if we never had the Bible, if we had to start from scratch and establish a healthy view of sexuality based on science alone, that these are the principles that would emerge. Now, this little talk isn't going to come close to a comprehensive overview. That would take many books and many hundreds of hours. This is a bird's eye view to give you the lay of the land. So don't sweat the details. I promise you that when I'm done this afternoon, I'm going to think of 100 things I wish I had mentioned. There is just so much out there on this subject. But this actually may be the most important issue for the global church in the 21st century. So here are the three points we're going to look at. The first is that gender differences are innate, that God created men and women to be different and that we are born that way. It's not just a construct of culture or society. Point number two is that human beings are designed for biblical marriage and sexuality within biblical parameters. quite simply, that means no sexual intercourse between anyone other than married husband and wife. That's it. The third principle is that there was a fall, that it happened, and we are damaged as a result of that. And because of that, there are going to be problems and frictions impacting these first two things on the list with catastrophic consequences to human society. Now, and normally at this point, I might have to take some time to work out the exegesis of all this, but that was really done well by your own pastor, Josh Swanson. I was doing some background research on your church, and I saw you did a series on sexuality in 2019, and I listened to his two talks on Adam and Eve and biblical view, and it was an outstanding presentation. He did all the heavy lifting for me. So this is, I'm following up that sermon from those two sermons from 2 years ago with the scientific apologetic that backs it up. So let's just jump right in. Point number one, gender differences. Is gender a social construct? You know, for most of human history, it was assumed that men and women were fundamentally different. Josh Swanson quoted, I think, Aristotle and Plato or Socrates, and they had a very distinct view of women. It was very misogynistic, but they very clearly saw them as very different from men. Now, John Money is a very important name in this whole realm. And 1965, there was a pair of identical twin boys who were born in Canada. And because of a medical problem, one of them required a circumcision. The circumcision turned out to be a disaster, and there was irreparable damage to one of the little boy's baby's penises. Dr. Money, they were made aware of Dr. Money, who is creating this gender identity clinic at Johns Hopkins University. So they got in contact with him, and he said, you know, just bring him out here. Everything will be fine. We'll turn him into a girl and raise him as a girl, and he will have a long, healthy, productive life. Well, he claimed that. Money was very active in this field in the late 60s, promoting the idea that gender is completely a social construct and that we're born a blank slate, that a baby could be a man, could be a woman. It's all yet to be decided. He started publishing, and he reported the follow-up on this Reimer baby. Well, somebody investigated this beginning in the 1990s and found out throughout the whole period of this research, so-called research, Money was lying. The boy who is the victim of his procedure, who was named Marilyn Reimer, rebelled at every stage, did not like being a girl, wanted to act like a boy, insisted on acting like a boy. Eventually, by early adulthood in his 20s, he realized, found out what had happened, and reverted to embracing a masculine identity. Tragically, he ultimately went on to commit suicide at 38. But Money never gave up on his hypothesis that this is all a social construct. Now, this idea is almost no longer existent in the scientific world, but it's still very common in the secular realm. Leonard Sachs, who wrote a book on male-female differences called Why Gender Matters, quotes one of his former professors as saying, most of the differences we observe between girls and boys are socially constructed. Daphne Joel at Tel Aviv University, there's no sense in talking about male and female nature. One of the early proponents of this view, Simone de Beauvoir, one of the earliest feminists, a consort of Jean-Paul Sartre, the philosopher, said, on ne n'est pas femme, on le devient. Now, there's actually a whole book of essays arguing over the exact translation of this phrase, and I promise you, you're not going to be tested on it. But what she was saying is, we are not born a woman, we become one. So this has been a theme. Let's go forward. What science has revealed over the last 20 to 30 years, something very different has emerged, that differences are real and they're biological and they're present at birth. Now, being a neuroradiologist, I sort of was aware that the 1990s was dubbed the decade of the brain by NIH. And so there was a lot of research. So all of this research really began in the 90s and has continued up to the present day. Here's a good little book if you want an overview of what science has found, but we find that fact that there are enormous differences between men and women on almost every level. He reviews some of the research and hearing, the auditory acuity can be almost the same, but women on whole tend to be more aware of noises around them than men. In the classroom, this translates into teachers who speak too softly, boys are gonna have a hard time paying attention to them. Now, these are broad categorizations, and there's always a lot of overlap because my wife and I are completely opposite. I'm way more aware of background noises than she was. And I was convinced her hearing was impaired until we went to the state fair and got a hearing test, and it was exactly the same. There was absolutely nothing wrong with her acuity. She could just tune it out. Now, smell, women tend to be much more sensitive to odors, and this is something that increases with increasing exposure, whereas men don't have that response. On the flip side, little boys are, as you know, much more inclined towards risk-taking and aggression. The risk-taking behaviors, the skateboarding down handrails and taking bicycles and jumping off cliffs, these are boy kind of things. Similarly, aggression, the fighting, the pummeling, the pounding. Now, people who say that this is just a social construct need to take a look at the social systems of all the primates, because these behaviors are found even in chimpanzees and monkeys. There's a species of Japanese macaque where they were researching and found it in the wild that females vastly outnumbered the males, and they couldn't explain why. And so they started eliminating all the possibilities. Were they killing each other? Was it some kind of illness? Was there a birth selection? What it eventually found out was that the male macaque monkeys were just far willing to take far greater risks when they were swinging between trees, and they were just dying from trauma from taking chances that they weren't up to. Similarly with aggression, we see higher levels of aggression very clearly demonstrated in male chimpanzees versus female chimpanzees. Learning styles are a big one. Women, little girls need to be more connected with their teacher on a personal level, whereas little boys, it's kind of irrelevant. They just want to master the subject and then get out and play. Boys and girls form friendships in different ways and set a different priority on them. Boys and girls differ in the response to babies, and this is very strong at the youngest ages. Clearly, there's a difference in sex drive between men and women. It's much more powerful in men. Attitudes towards sex, particularly intercourse, the male attitude towards and perception of the act of sexual intercourse is very different than how a woman views it and relates to it. Now, there's an enormous amount, and I could go on and on. There was a good study that came out about 2 years ago. This was the largest study ever done examining sex differences. It came out of the UK and was published in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. And they measured people according to the empathy quotient that measured ability to detect emotional responses in other people and an awareness and concern for those emotional systems versus the systems quotient, which is analysis, figuring out how things work and why things work. Overall, females were higher in the empathy quotient and males higher in the systems quotient. This is what the data showed, that type E were the empathetic type. Among females, 40% were the empathetic type, whereas only 25% were the systematizing type. And in males, it was strongly reversed. Only 13% of males were empathic. Over 50% were type S or system quotient scoring high. Another thing this shows, though, is that there's nothing that's a great wall of separation between men and women. There's always overlap in these departments, that everybody's complex, that everybody's a composite. But there are definite differences overall. And what we also find is that it is biological, and it starts in the brain, and it has mostly to do with the function of the brain, not the structure of the brain. I spent decades looking at brain MRIs and CTs, and today I couldn't, if you gave me an MRI scan, I couldn't look at it and say, well, that's a man or that's a woman. There is a very slight difference in the midline commissure called the corpus callosum that takes white matter fibers from one hemisphere to the other. With women, it's slightly greater in cross-section, but there's so much overlap, it's useless as a differentiator between one and the other. Some more evidence has come from young women who are afflicted with CAH, congenital adrenal hyperplasia, where they have more endogenous testosterone. So their development is somewhere biologically, somewhere between male and female on the physical level. And in the same respect, their behaviors on all these things that I listed, they tend to be more masculinized and more halfway between the stereotypical male and stereotypical female in their development. And the way this is mediated through a large part is through testosterone, which is produced even in utero at higher levels in baby boys, and in the brain, specifically in the DNA of the nuclei, there are androgen receptors. And the testosterone binds to androgen receptors and controls gene expression. So by the time an infant is born, his brain has been wired to be male or to be female. The CAG codon is something that is bound to the part of the DNA where the receptor attaches, and it, men with higher levels of the CAG codon have less expression of the testosterone, and vice versa. The ones that have the fewest codons, there's more expression of male characteristics. So we can prove this down to even a molecular level. As I said, that's just going to be an overview, and this culminated in 2017 in publication of the Journal of Neuroscience Research. The notion that sex matters fundamentally, powerfully, pervasively for all of neuroscience, not just for reproduction, is an idea whose time has come, said Larry Cahill in an editorial opening this issue. You know, we talk about follow the science, but right now, most of the media and educational establishments are still living in the 1980s, imagining that most male-female differences actually are social constructs. So just a few caveats before I move on to the next subject. So both man, masculine and feminine personae exist along a continuum. There's any woman is going to express some of these male characteristics and vice versa. It's not an either or. Some gender roles indeed are socially and culturally determined. No, somehow in the West in the 20th century, it became that most secretaries were females, but that didn't, well, that wasn't true historically. You read Dickens, there are no female secretaries in 18th century or 19th century England. The significant overlap is inevitable, but it varies with the traits. Some are more strong than others. For instance, traits regarding a sex drive, it's much more distinctive between men and women. Many of these differences actually decrease with age and experience. With education and professional experience, women can learn to be more aggressive when they need to be, and men can learn to tame their impulses. And I'm not going to talk about public policy at all today. That's just beyond the scope of this. So let's move on to the next issue, which is biblical marriage and sexuality. The second point is that marriage is designed by God and is optimal for human flourishing. Christian marriage is based upon the principles of diversity, that men and women are different, and that that's good. And that The second, complementarity, builds upon this, that because we're different, and we are different in ways that we can complement one another, and the two together are stronger than the one alone. The third principle is that of interdependence and exchange. The both sides of the relationship have something to give and also something to gain. They depend on one another, and there's a trade-off of who can bring what to the relationship. It should never be one-sided or lopsided. So biblical marriage is incorporated into human design. So what does that mean? This is a principle of natural law. It shows that because it's part of our design, that if we follow that principle, we're much more likely to succeed at life. Things are just going to work better. And the basic principle is that of lifelong heterosexual monogamy. Any departure from that is going to go against natural law, go against our design, is going to lead to adverse consequences. You know, a popular question that might come up is, what about polygamy in the Old Testament? Well, Jesus answered that. He said it was never part of the design from the beginning. Now, there's a common perception, I think, in Christian communities that the Mosaic Law was intended as some sort of comprehensive code, that everything prohibited in Mosaic Law was against the law of God, and everything permitted was okay, but that was never the intent of the Mosaic Law. So why does complementarity matter? Well, we find it is optimal for child rearing. In everything, there has to be balance. Overprotection will lead to needy and insecure children, but no protection at all will also lead to irresponsible and overly secure, risk-taking children who might end up dead. So children need to learn the balance between healthy and unhealthy aggression, between overprotection and excessive risk-taking. So that's how our differences come together. It enhances maturity in a healthy relationship. Now, as we identify these sex differences, it's not saying that one is good and the other bad. It's more like it shows where men need to grow and where women need to grow. Men need to have some of their impulses toned down a bit, and women might need to have some of their weaknesses compensated, and together we grow, whereas apart we don't. It incentivizes personal growth. There's a reason to grow in maturity when you're seeking a marital relationship. It's optimal for household functioning. Households are just function better when all the jobs are taken care of, when the house cleaning, the cooking, the breadwinning, the yard, when all these are taken together. And some people are just going to be better at one thing than another. It's optimal for long-term happiness and mental health. And what we also find is that monogamous societies compared to polygamous ones outperformed all others in historical terms. So I mentioned that some of these positive outcomes of marriage are improved health. What research has found is it also leads to higher levels of happiness, higher economic prosperity, increased lifespans, and that children fare much better when raised by both biological parents. Much better than children born out of wedlock or children who are in blended homes or were products of divorce. I'm not even going to have time to get into the research here, but this is what is emerging. There's an excellent new book out just this spring by Katie Foss and Stacey Manning called Them Before Us. And it focuses especially on children and how in our current society, adults' interests and desires have been placed first and foremost, and children have been sacrificed on the altar of adult desire. By almost every imaginable parameter, children fare better when raised by their married biological parents. In their book, they talk about all the issues and problems that are happening to children because of being separated from their biological parents, including safety. I just finished a gig where I was working at Scottish Rite Hospital in Atlanta, and we would see children being brought in, victims of terrible abuse, severe head injuries, some just horrible problems. And the feeling in the medical community is often one of judgment that this is scum of the earth. These are horrible people, and they are. But what you would find, and what few people realize, is that number one, the perpetrator is almost always a male. And number two, perpetrator is almost never the biological father. It's almost always a cohabitating male or a male friend of the mother who is there, not because he's interested in the child, is there because he's interested in the mother and what she has to offer him. Children who are separated from their parents struggle with identity, with mental and physical health, with economic and academic success, and in their general social well-being. Their ones without mothers or fathers are more likely to end up in crime and prison and suicide. And they make one point in their book, which is really quite excellent, that we need to get rid of this term called parenting, that there's no such thing as parenting. There's mothering and there's fathering, and children need both. So what they conclude is that the rights of children should be very simple, three things: to be raised by their biological father, biological mother, in a stable home environment. And if you provide these things to any child, they will beat all odds and tend to do extremely well in future in life. What do we know about marriage and health? We know that marriage reduces depression, that unmarried adults are more likely to drink, use marijuana, and drive recklessly, that married men and women experience lower mortality at every age relative to those who remain unmarried or lose their spouse through widowhood or divorce. I'm reading from a review published in 2010. Of course, there's just more data since then. A number of studies reveal that marriage also leads to better general physical health and better outcomes for specific health conditions, including arthritis, hypertension, and heart disease. I'm looking at the time, and I'm going to skip this one so we can move on to the next one. Mark Regnerus has written about this, although he's not the originator of this idea, but what has changed in the last few decades is how we perceive marriage. They talk about the foundation view. Foundation view of marriage was that you married young, you established a home together, you started out and launched a career together, you raised children together starting in the peak years of fertility, which is in the 20s. That's the foundation view of marriage. The new view they call the capstone view, encapsulated then in this Atlantic headline, marriage has become a trophy. With the capstone view, the idea is that the marriage is the pinnacle. You wait and hold off on marriage until you're established into your career, until you're financially independent. And only then do you think about finding that perfect person to complete your life. That's a capstone view. Now, Gary Becker in 1973 Journal of Political Economy introduced the idea of a marriage market. It's a idea of a mutual beneficial relationship based on needs rather than wants. That's more of the foundational view. Whereas today it's a capstone. I think you're seeing that a lot. Moving on to number three, the consequences of the fall. Now, the biblical paradigm was really never a natural state after the fall. When Jesus was incarnate on the earth, the corrupted view was rampant. It was a time of terrible abuse of children, of the weak, of women. In every respect, they were not well treated because of the unbiblical views of sexuality. So the first sexual revolution was really when Christianity improved the lot of women and children by taming male impulses. What we call the sexual revolution of the 60s was really a relapse to a more primitive state of affairs, with a lot of empty rhetoric about the liberation of women who have suffered more than anyone in the ensuing 50 years. So there's been a radical change both from the mores of the sexual revolution and the decline in marriage that I talked about, which are closely related. Now, the cultural rejection of biblical sexuality has led to victims, especially women and children. Now, we can talk about the direct victims. Those are the victims of sexual assault that we've heard about, including the Me Too trend, the Catholic Church scandals, the Boy Scouts of America scandals. But the numbers in public schools just don't get reported as much, but on a sheer number basis, vastly exceed the Catholic Church and the Boy Scouts of America scandals. And of course, the victims of the sexual revolution must include the millions of children who have been aborted over the last 50 years. Now, when we talk about victims of sexual aggression, if we want to know the why, we have to look at the victims. We have to look at the predators to find out what's happening here. And in the last couple of decades, science has shed a lot of light on the factors that increase or decrease predatory behaviors. We know that predators are overwhelmingly male, though not exclusively. The victims are predominantly female, with a few exceptions. For instance, in the Catholic Church abuse scandal, 81% of the victims were male. In the Boy Scout scandals, 100% were male. Now, there are innate male characteristics that thing boy-girl differences I talked about, high sex drive, aggression, risk-taking, predispose men towards being predators. But constraining male aggression through rigid moral codes has been an achievement of advanced society fostered by Christianity. And that's the nutshell. I mean, instead of Christianity being framed as repressive and legalistic and puritanical, it's been a bastion of protection for women and children for 2,000 years. But Western society has now regressed and the consequences have been dire. About 30 years ago, Neil Malamuth came up with a confluence model here of sexual aggression. And he identified two factors. One is hostile masculinity, the hyper-aggressive, macho, misogynistic attitude that develops in some men. The second that he identified is impersonal sexual orientation. Now, this has nothing to do with sexual preference. It is how you think about sex. Thinking about sex is nothing very important, just a very casual thing. He came up with the first two. Now, in the last 10 years, there's been a third leg to this stool, and that's consumption of pornography. These three things are established as very strong risk factors for development of sexual predators and therefore to victims. Now, one of the things I talked about was casual attitude towards sex. Well, how do they measure that? And the tool they use is this. It's called the Revised Sociosexual Orientation Inventory, and they survey. And it's really quite interesting. We don't have time to read this, but every one of these expresses a view where Christianity would have a different position. And for instance, with how many different partners have you had sex within the past 12 months? You know, a Christian response would be either 0 or 1, a non-Christian response or something running against the biblical sexual ethic would be different. We could go right on down the line. Number 4, sex without love is okay. All these are, the higher the score, the greater risk of aggression, except for number 6. I do not want to have sex with a person until I am sure that we will have a long-term serious relationship. That is scored negatively. But if you're a Christian who has a Christian worldview and a Christian attitude towards sexuality would score extremely low, and someone who fully embraced the cultural secular narrative would tend to score high. And that is a predictor of sexual aggression. Now, I've already talked about children as victims. They face consequences in terms of their physical health, their safety, their emotional health, social functioning, academic attainment, identity, yearnings, all of these. Children are victims of this fall. And the indirect victims are all of us because of the rise in crime, because of poverty. Loneliness is a major factor. People are having greater difficulty establishing stable relationships. Mental illness, depression, anxiety, suicide, economic impact of declining populations in Western societies. So, moral of communities effect, I will probably not have time to get into. But of course, you're aware that sexually transmitted diseases are another risk of non-biblical sex, but no one cares. We see the CDC reports last year for In 2019, sexually transmitted diseases reached an all-time high for the sixth consecutive year. But nobody cares about this. Why do we not use this as apologetic? What did I just tell you about men? They're aggressive and they're risk takers. So this kind of reasoning is not going to be very effective using against the men you need to be talking to. Mark Regnerus, I talked about earlier, came out with this phenomenal book in 2017 called Cheap Sex, where he talks about the whole principle of sexual economics. It's not one that he developed originally, but he's written about it. And in this, men dominate the demand side for sex because of their innate sex drive, whereas females are typically the gatekeepers. They're more reluctant, and historically because they had more at risk. Now, in the current realm, females dominate the market for marriage, where males dominate a separate market for sex outside of marriage. The price of sex is reflected in what it costs an individual to obtain a partner. So what does that mean exactly? This is really quite useful, and it's what I'm going to wrap up with. With driven down the price of sex are some of the things I've listed here. The pill, of course, was the first one to dramatically reduce the risk to men and women, but especially women, but in reducing the cost. It also made it cheaper in economic terms. Some of the more contemporary trends include internet dating and smartphone apps that some phrase as nothing more than sex delivery systems. Lower expectations from females. Well, women are just more willing, even if reluctant, to engage in sex outside of marriage. They're willing to settle for lower standards. And this is changing the attitudes towards marriage that I talked about. That going from the traditional view to the capstone view, where if you're embracing the capstone view, that pushes marriage out 10 or 15 years. That's a long time to be celibate. So the opportunities, the desires, all lead to a situation where they're much more likely to engage in premarital intercourse or multiple partners. Pornography has reduced the price of sex because what it's the cheapest sex of all is what pornography has to offer. Marriage, on the other hand, remains expensive because of this capstone view. But the consequences of that are the things that I've talked about already. Because of cheap sex, people are less happy. There's increased frustration, increased loneliness, because one of the best cures for loneliness is marriage. Reduced religious engagement. Couples that cohabitate or non-cohabitating couples that are sexually active are much less likely to attend church, even if they come from a church background. More liberal political tendencies. Now, you can judge for yourself whether that's good or bad, but it's been well documented. Masculine acedia, what does that mean? Well, acedia is sort of a lassitude, a laziness. For some men, not all, and at no point do I wish to stereotype all men because we're talking about averages, but for some men, the only incentive for them to succeed in life, to try hard in school, to get and keep a job, to develop a personal, a disciplined personal life, their only main motivator is to get married so they can have sex. But if they don't have to get married, then the whole thing falls apart. Fewer and fewer people are getting married, and it's mostly not because the women don't want to, but because men don't have to. And this, of course, leads to reduced fertility. And the way this feeds into loneliness is because people are getting married less, they're having fewer children. You have fewer siblings, they have smaller families, more single child families. Fewer siblings means fewer cousins, fewer aunts and uncles. And it feeds upon itself because they don't, one of the causes for loneliness is an extended family, but children being raised in some societies with very low birth rates don't have that extended family. Growing up with opposite sex siblings and relatives is one of the best ways to learn to understand the opposite sex. But with the declining birth rates, they don't have that opportunity. So all of this feeds together into one large situation where the church and society at large are being hurt. Roy Baumeister is a social psychologist from Florida State, and he's actually the one who coined the term sexual economics in 2012, he wrote this quote that sex has become free and easy. This is today's version of the opiate of the male masses. The male who beds multiple women is quite enjoying life, and he may not notice. And then he goes on to talk about some of the affirmative action things to advance women in the workplace. And he says, men don't care as long as they're getting sex. So there are winners and there are losers. Who are the losers in this? Well, most women, basically all children, in fact, most adults. Who are the winners in the current situation? The sexual paradigm that's being promoted by secular society, the winners are sexual predators. You know, it's the Harvey Weinsteins, it's Jeffrey Epstein's. And those are the ones for whom the cows come home to roost, chickens come home to roost, cows do something else. But most of the time, the chickens don't come home to roost. You can be a sexual predator and president of the United States. I think that's been shown. So in summary, I said at the beginning, there are three principles of sexuality defined by the Bible. And in the talk today, I've shown that what science has established in the last several decades, even though the cultural narrative is radically different, what science has shown is that men and women are biologically different and they complement one another, that sex within biblical marriage is the optimal paradigm for human flourishing, and that departure from biblical sexuality inflicts great civilizational and individual harm. That looks like about 45 minutes there. Now, next week, some questions may come up. If some people are suffering as a consequence, why is this so popular? Second, how did these beliefs emerge? And more importantly, you know, agree that this is a problem. What are the possible remedies? And so that's what I want to get into next week. And I'm going to offer some scientific answers to this and some biblical answers to this. So please stay tuned. And I'm going to end my screen sharing there.
And thank you.
Thank you for your attention.
We have a couple of questions. The first one comes from Juven from the Netherlands. And he says, some boys or girls claim that they're trapped in the body of the opposite gender. Is this merely biological, or can that involve some spiritual influence?
Spiritual influences I'm going to talk about next week. The whole trans thing, I specifically wanted to avoid LGBTQ issues in this talk, because I think once you go down that, it sucks all the oxygen out of the room. And I fear for much of the last 20 years, it's kept the church distracted from what is a core issue, which is what their children are doing. There's essentially nothing biological that would support the trans idea that there are other biological genders and that you have to discover that, or you could possibly be born with a wrong biological gender. In a sense, gender and sex are the same. Now, I think you have to be very careful with the edges of that, because what Simone de Beauvoir said, that we're not born a woman, we become one, that's not completely untrue either. I think, in many cases, the truth is a balance. In fact, while there are definite innate biological differences between men and women, it's not all one or all the other. It's a continuum in every case. And on top of that, some of the perceptions, career choices or, hobbies, so much of it, things that we do really are culturally and socially determined. And I don't have any special insights into the trans thing. I know people who do, who've worked with them, who've written books on it, but it's not biological. I don't think I have looked up some of the neuroscience papers on it, and there's nothing in the realm of neuroscience that would indicate a biological or chemical or neurotransmitter mediated cause for it.
Thank you. Another follow-up question to that is, what do you think of the works done by Jordan Peterson on gender issues?
I don't follow Jordan Peterson a whole lot. I read his first book, The 12 Rules for Life, I didn't find anything at all in there that I strongly disagreed with, but I can't remember because he said so much. So this is not a blanket endorsement. I found him, I probably won't read a second book. I found it tedious. I think he's very wordy and verbose and could have said the same thing in a much shorter book, is my impression of Jordan Peterson. But unless they mention something specifically that he said, I don't have any problem with what he's been saying to the extent of my recollection.
Okay, thank you. Another question is, how would you use the information that, for example, that you brought to us today, if you're teaching a group of teenagers in a church, like a Sunday school, youth group or something like that, and you wanted to encourage them to follow the biblical precepts instead of following the cultural precepts? Is there anything that you'd give us as advice as how we might want to approach something like that?
Next week, I'll talk about some of where we began. The first thing everybody needs to know, if you don't agree with anything I said today about this being a critical need, then please go out and read more books, read more research, listen to what people are saying and look at the data and see what it's showing. But if you're convinced that this is a critical need, the first thing we need to do is get more people on board caring about it, because people only have limited capacity for attention and they will respond to whatever is the greatest need. In my circles, I don't see the church paying very much attention to this. They're more concerned with the political realm and they're more concerned with dealing with some of the things happening in the state and local political levels than what's happening in their own churches. You know, I am obviously not a high school teacher. You know, how you take, I think for college students, you would probably just go right like what I did and present it. You know, I think it would need to be repackaged significantly for high school students. I can't make that leap from what I just did to high school students. What I need is to get enough people to care that people who are on board with it can develop age-appropriate curricula for that. That's the best answer I can come up with specifically that question.
That's a great answer. Thank you very much. Next week, you're going to be talking about, remind us one more time what we'll be getting into next week.
I'm going to talk about the science of cognition. You know, I sort of made a case that if what I said in the talk today is true, that it means that about 80 to 90% of American society has bought into a lie. And how do you explain that? Much of our mindset is that people form their beliefs on the basis of facts, logic, and experience. And so therefore, if they believe something wrong, then all you have to do is present them with a better argument. I'm going to challenge that assumption on every level. So that's what we're going to do, because I think we need to understand why people believe what they do. And armed with that knowledge, maybe come up with a better approach towards challenging it.
Thank you. I have a couple of questions left. Do you have time or do you want me to hold them till
next? Plenty of time.
Okay. The first one is from Tonette, and she says, I teach kindergarten and first grade, and I've noticed as early as 5 and 6 that a child seems to be aligned more with the opposite gender. When these children grow up, I'm not surprised that they're coming out. Can you explain that?
Again, I didn't really want to get into LGBTQ issues. It would be an area for a whole different talk. I do believe that there are a lot of cultural inputs, and that's something I can partially address next week. There are a lot of cultural inputs. Young children today are seeing a lot of YouTube. They're seeing a lot of video. They're hearing what's going on around them, and it imprints upon them. The children that she's talking about, I said that there are biological influences and there are indeed cultural influences. And I can't judge on a case by case, nor would I even attempt to judge on a case by case basis, whether it's biological or whether it's cultural, but there are people who've done that. Specifically in the area of homosexuality, the official position of both the American Psychiatric Association and the American Psychological Association is that the causes for same-sex attraction or homosexuality are unknown, but almost multifactorial. There may be some genetic component, but it's untenable to say that it's strictly genetic. Even among identical twins, the coincidence of same-sex attraction comes to less than 25%. If it were completely genetic, every time you had with identical twin pairs, if one was homosexual, the other would always be homosexual and vice versa. But that's not what happens at all. With identical twins, if one is homosexual, it's only a 1 in 8 chance approximately that the other will be. And so that might be higher than random, and it might be higher than fraternal twins or biological twins. So there may be a genetic component. There's also the possibility, not of genetics, but gene modulation, the effect of maternal hormones and the effect of circulating hormones in the baby. And then there are cultural influences. And we don't, the problem with homosexuality is that there's a surprising lack of interest in researching the causes for it. And so I think we'll probably go on not knowing. People probably don't want to know the cause for it in the current political environment.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you. We have a question here from Tim Williams, who says, you mentioned CAH-afflicted females. Do you know how prevalent such cases are? And is there a case for considering transgendering among such individuals?
It's very rare, actually. And in their case, they would probably just let them live how they want to live. I don't know.
Okay. All right, we'll leave it at that. We have one last question from Steve. It says, is there research showing sexual identity confusion stemming from a childhood sexual violation?
There's been a lot of writing on that. I know in the 90s, some of the group stuff coming out of Focus on the Family and Mayer were saying that one of the major causes for homosexuality was childhood the sexual abuse. And then there was a backlash, and they say no, that the other political side said there's no validity to that. My best take right now is that probably is some validity to it. It's higher than expected. Now there's the opposing view that says, well, it's just because if they were boys, it's just because they were seemingly effeminate as a young child that made them targets and therefore more likely to become a victim. So on the one hand, they're acknowledging that there is a disparity. They're admitting that they are more likely to have a history of sexual abuse in childhood, but they're kind of blaming it on the perpetrator and saying that it's an effect of being homosexual, not a cause. Again, it's not an area where we're likely to see objective research, because I don't think people really want to know the answer to that either. The truth is that there's, you know, I'm way more concerned of the broader issue of sexual victimization, regardless of the identities of the male or the female. It's the big picture we need to stay focused on.
Yes. Truth. Thank you very, very much. Dr. Wong, we appreciate you doing this and being with us next week. I'm really looking forward to that. So I'm hoping that the rest of the people who are here will come in early. We normally would start at 10:45 with Hugh's stuff, with the Q&A at 10:30. So what we're gonna do is we're gonna come in at 10:35 Pacific Daylight Time next week and start from the beginning. So I hope everybody joins us at 10:35 next week. And with that, Dr. Willing, thank you very much again, and we look forward to seeing you next week. Take care, everybody.
Thank you, Mark. My voice held out.
That's okay. You work great. Bye-bye.
Thanks. Bye.